When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Looking for something to do after Halloween is over? Are you into the strange, bizarre, and unusual? On November 3rd, 4th, and 5th, the Strange Realities Conference is coming back to Nashville, Tennessee, and streaming online. Come join us for 3 days exploring mysteries, supernatural, the occult, weird history, and more, featuring lectures, presentations, and workshops by Tim Banal, Zach Hunt, Leslyn Vance, Bryn Collier, Tobias Whalen, Brent Rains, Joshua Kutchen, Kiki Dombrowski, Recluse, Nathan Isaac, Christopher Ernst, Aaron Goulias, David Metcalf, Timothy Renner, Mallory Sawinski, Soraya Azcap, and special guest Steve Berg as your Master of Ceremonies. Make sure to join us for the fun and informative weekend online and at SIR Nashville November 3rd and 4th and online only November 5th. Tickets are available at strangerealitiesconference.com.
Okay, well, we just feel that anticipation in the room as that countdown goes on. Man, I'm still just by that total, that absolute intensity there. So we'll just put Surfiel there real quick just to, just to show what's going on here, that we have a special guest joining us tonight for the Strange Realities Conference preview.
Undergone some changes, or is this your real face?
Yeah,
this is my real face. Yeah,
you know who you also look like. You look like the abominable Dr. Fibes.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. There's a little bit of that with the teeth.
Right.
Dr. Fibes.
Yeah. That's the abominable Dr. Fibes has joined us tonight, everyone.
what just happened? just came out of somewhere else, man.
Wow. I think you're up in the Pacific Northwest, so I think we had harp frequency stuff is, you know.
Yeah, we had a transmission from the reptilian overlords or the Collins elite, one of the two. So, welcome everybody. We are continuing the countdown to Strange Realities 2023 coming up here November 3rd through the 4th and the 5th in Nashville, Tennessee and online. And tonight we have another set of speakers. We have three speakers that are going to be speaking on the online day coming up on November 5th, and another speaker that is going to be speaking on November 3rd, that Friday evening. So I want to welcome everybody. Zach Hunt, welcome back to Conspiranormal.
Thanks again for having me. It's an honor.
Absolutely, man. I'm glad that you're here. And we've got Christopher Ernst.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me.
And hasn't been on for a little while. And
I have not. No,
neither have.
I've been busy.
Yeah, and Aaron Goulias is here with us as well.
Yes. Hello. 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 Hello.
And last but not least, David Metcalf is also with us too.
Always good to join y'all.
Yeah. Sure. Always good to have you. So, we are going to do what we have done the last few weeks, which has been to talk about what you guys have discussed, what you guys are going to be presenting at the Strange Realities Conference coming up in Nashville, Tennessee and online. And you guys can see for everybody watching at the moment or that are going to be watching here fairly shortly, www.strangerealitiesconference.com is where you can get tickets. Tickets are very much still available for both online and also for in person. So, but to let you guys know, the whole entire conference is being streamed online. So if you get an online ticket, you will be able to see the entire thing all 3 days.
And like we always say, if you miss any of it, if you do come in person but you miss any of it, you can also catch that online. So it works both ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just like you are watching, if you're on the Facebook group that we are using for to stream the conference, you can go back and watch this. So it's exactly the same. We have several of these up now as well. So you guys can go watch that. That's only one of the places that I'm streaming this to. It's also being streamed to YouTube. So, gentlemen, let's get into it. Let's talk about what you guys are going to talk about at Strange Realities. And Zach, I have not been able to really talk to you about what you're going to be presenting, but I'm really excited to know what you're going to be talking about.
Yeah, well, I guess two things, but in one, I originally planned on talking about like the rapture, you know, and end times theology and that stuff. And then, you know, the stuff that's happened in Israel made that more pertinent, I guess.
Right.
And so, you know, what I plan on kind of doing is, you know, you see, obviously this is a more, you know, poignant or dramatic or serious moment than, you know, a lot of times when end times prophecies, you know, get pushed. But I think it's a good jumping off point to talk about that kind of stuff and to debunk it, not debunk what's going on there, but debunk the way that, you know, this theology gets used to like grift, you know, a lot of folks, the way, you know, moments like this, you know, you have these horrible tragedies that can get compounded, you know, by people who, you know, some just have bad theology, but some are also looking to make a buck, you know, because there's a formula for this kind of stuff. You know, something bad happens in Israel or Russia or fill in the blank, and then you've got this, you know, formula for, okay, now Jesus is going to come back. Now the end of the world's happening. Now the seven bowls of wrath, blah, 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 blah. And it happens, you know, year in and year out, you know, with different events. And, you know, this one's just one of the, you know, different magnitude, obviously, than, you know, some stuff that's gone before. But yeah, I want to walk through that and talk about, you know, why that kind of stuff is problematic, but then also find, you know, some hope, you know, and some, you know, good news and that kind of stuff too. Not specifically the rapture, but, you know, the book of Revelation, you know, when it's weirdness and oddness and, you know, hard to understand this, and find, you know, the truth that there is in myth. You know, I grew up, you know, kind of a fundamentalist sort of background, and the idea of myth and truth were always polar opposites for me. You know, if something was a myth, then it wasn't true. And, you know, one thing that I've come to see or believe, at least as I've, you know, grown up and got older, is that couldn't be further from the truth, that, you know, myth conveys truth in a way that, you know, like history and like literalism can't, you know, because myth can transcend space and time and culture and context in ways that history can't. And so I think that like a book like Revelation, you know, for all its weirdness, if we can sort of get back or step away from looking at it as like this literalist, you know, roadmap to the future and begin to see the story, you know, that it's trying to tell, that it can offer hope, especially in a moment like this that's, you know, really scary, you know, and dark, that, you know, there's still light, you know, at the end of the tunnel. And even in the, you know, crazy books like Revelation, that hope and that good news can still spring forth, you know, if we learn to read the story the way it was meant to be told.
All right. Yeah, that's excellent. That's very well put. Guys, if I don't know if you know who Zach is, but he's written several books now about these type of subjects. Unraptured, and there was the other book about where he really took like a really critical eye on the whole concept of biblical inerrancy. And I think you do a really good job of kind of debunking a lot of the myths that are used, especially by like the religious right, but then reconstructing people for people to have a hope in the same kind of literature, and that it's not, you're freeing it from the craziness.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's, I think it's how it's used, you know, is what it comes down to, you know, like regardless of like the religious text or, you know, secular text, you know, it's not always the text itself that's the problem, but, you know, how people choose to use it, you know, because, you know, you can use a text like the Bible for great things and you can use it for terrible things. And so, you know, with my work and my writing, you know, I'm hoping to help folks, you know, tell better stories, you know, that are worth believing in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is like a real, real topical thing too.
Yeah, Zach was at the very first Strange Realities spoke in person in 2019.
That's right. Good memories from that too. People, I think.
Is there a? I know we streamed that a few years ago. Is that available anywhere yet, Adam?
Yeah, well, it's still, I mean, it's still on the Conspiranormal YouTube page.
Okay, so yeah, if you want to go,
You would have to scroll down pretty far down. It's pretty far down. I think we streamed it right before the 2020 conference.
Okay.
But it is actually there. It's mixed in with some of the other presentations, but it is actually there. Eventually, my goal is to put a lot of these up individually. But that's a long-term, kind of a long-term goal right now.
But we always like having your perspective, Zach. And
thanks.
Yeah, you've been here since the beginning.
Thanks. I'm genuinely honored to be hanging out with you guys. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We're honored to have you as well. And it also really helps that you're here in Nashville, and also too, that you're aware of how crazy things can get, here in Nashville, how Nashville has kind of become, it's kind of become a center of like, a lot of right wing type of stuff right now. So,
oh yeah. Big time.
What's like Ben Shapiro's group has moved here. Was that the Daily Wire? And
yeah. Matt Walsh, excuse me. Yeah. I saw him at dinner one time. I did not chat with him.
Ben Shapiro, you mean the grown-up kid from the Children of the Corn?
Right, exactly.
Watch it. You'll see.
Yeah. Zach, are you going, when you're there, are you going to get the Barbie playset and like hit it with a Bible?
I'll send a special invite to Greg Locke. You know, his church is just down the street from my house. It's like about 2 miles away.
It absolutely. You still got
any of those billboards up?
Oh man, no, my budget's not that big.
Right. But you did at a time you had a couple, right? At least
I did. Yeah, I put them up. You know, I intentionally tried to troll Ben Shapiro and Matt Walsh and them by putting it over by their headquarters over in Berry Hill. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. they didn't take the bait. But part of that's because my more inflammatory, I guess, billboards did not get approved by the legal counsel of Lamar Advertising, mm-hmm. which was an interesting experience.
Yes. Yeah, that could be like a whole show in and of itself, probably. We could probably
talk about that's that. A conspiracy, it sounds like.
Yes. My conspiracy there is that their legal counsel is run by the Southern Baptist Convention. Otherwise, I can't really make heads or tails of why they turned them down.
Yeah, for sure.
Don't they believe in free speech?
Apparently not at Lamar.
So, you guys, everybody that's listening, Friday evening, 7:30 to 8:30, that is November 3rd. That is when Zach is going to be presenting. So you're going to Tim Banal is going to follow you. So I'm just going to warn you that it's going to be a
it's a powerhouse duo right there.
What you're leading into is you got to set it. You got to set it up really well.
Awesome. What's he going to be speaking on?
Tim, I think is going to be. I think he's going to be talking about some like grab bag of topics from the paranormal world, some of the paranormal weirdness and tomfoolery that's been going on. That's what he's kind of, you know, been looking at doing, I think. So, and there may be some extra things we're doing on Friday night. Not going to drop it just yet, but there's a possibility. So,
cool.
All right. And so you guys.
Will there be reptilians?
There may be reptilians, yes.
You might not be able to tell who they are, right?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what was the guy, Aaron, that the not Steamboat Willie. What's the guy's name that was accused?
Boxcar Willie.
Boxcar Willie. Yes.
Boxcar Willie was a lizard person. Yeah. I stand by that.
Monarch yeah. operations in Nashville, Tennessee.
That's right. Yeah. If you take Kathy O'Brien at her word, and why wouldn't you? Yeah, Boxcar Willie and, oh, God, a guy named Alex Houston, who apparently had a ventriloquist act or something. Like, he was the really bad guy. But, yeah, Nashville was sort of the center of all this. Branson as well, of course. I don't know if Andy Williams was involved, but I like to think he was.
That's that Mena Airport CIA dope was being carried. Well,
wasn't the Fiddler's Inn? Wasn't the Fiddler's Inn involved with that somehow?
Yeah, Fiddler's Inn, yep. According to Fritz Springmeier, is yep. is a Monarch programming site. So that will be very close to the vicinity of where most of our speakers will be staying too.
That's right.
Why aren't you staying at the Fiddler's Inn?
You missed a lot. They'll have a lot of. Insect visitors there probably from the looks of it from the outside.
So. All right. Well, we'll move on to you, Aaron. I'm curious of what you're going to be presenting on.
Yeah, me too. No, I do have a topic. I was going to say it's weird. It's not weird. It's actually kind of sweet. So one of the things I've been interested in the last few months is the Detroit flying saucer scene in the 50s and into the 60s, because these people who organized themselves into the Detroit Flying Saucer Club were overwhelmingly middle class, late middle age professionals who were usually into some spiritualist topics, but they were not. They weren't like hanging out with the IM cult or anything like that, but they get interested in UFOs through George Adamski. And in the 1950s, like some of the earliest appearances of Adamski outside of his Southern California burger stand were in Detroit multiple times, playing to increasingly large audiences at venues that were like legit, like the auditorium at the Detroit Institute of Arts and the big Masonic Temple auditorium. I think it was at least 2,000 or 3,000 people bought tickets in Detroit, you know, to go see George Adamski give a talk. And then they brought in Truman Bethram, and they brought in Buck Nelson, and they brought in George Hunt Williamson, and they sort of served as a booking agency for these contactees in the 1950s. And this is not, you know, giant rock where all the people, you know, who like this stuff congregate. This is we run ads in the paper and we sell tickets at a local bookstore and people show up, which is fascinating. But beyond that, the FBI has quite a bit of paperwork on the Detroit Flying Saucer Club, mostly because people are like, these folks are weird. I think you should check them out. And so they were checked out for being politically subversive in some ways. One woman who was involved, named Laura Mundo, would go on to, she was sort of Adamski's right-hand person in Detroit and has some scandalous stories about him, stuff that not acceptable in any day or age, but much more vocally unacceptable in our day and age as far as his behavior. And she's got interesting justifications for that. She has a break with Adamski. She goes off on her own. One of the Saucer Life listeners has really gotten into Laura Mundo. He's local to Detroit, and he's found all kinds of stuff, like her pamphlet titled "To the Militant Black Man" in like 1967, where this middle-aged white woman from suburban Detroit explains to militant black men why they need to settle down, which is, my God. So just like, Interesting take, but it's very much of its time. But she ties it into the cosmic wisdom and things like that. She ran this interplanetary center in Dearborn, which was, you know, her house, and sort of not like harassed and victimized for her beliefs by the neighbors, but made fun of because she was a weirdo and her house is always full of weirdos. It's an interesting story, all in all. It's a real slice of how the contactee stuff played out on the ground in a city that was not California, that was not Howard Menger land out in New Jersey. I almost said New Missouri, but that's New Jersey and Missouri put together. I think it's an interesting tale of how regular people get drawn into this. And since I've done anything about it on the show, I've come across additional things she's written. One of her relatives emailed me with a scanned copy of the unpublished memoir that she wrote, in which she changed all the names, but it's pretty obvious. Her granddaughter apparently sent me a message on Instagram that I need to get back to her about. I keep forgetting, but she's like local to me. So it's a really interesting story and a kind of slice of saucer life of the saucer scene back then that you won't get anywhere else, maybe for good reason, but you won't get it anywhere else.
Awesome. That sounds great, Aaron. We're really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I always enjoy Aaron's presentations.
Well, thank you.
Aaron's presentations as well. So, and should say that we are getting into, you guys are all the ones that are going to be online only on the 5th. Mm-hmm. And should also say for everybody, these times that I'm giving, these are central time zone times. So
I need to write that down, actually. Yeah,
so when you're doing this, you know, so 1:20 to 2:20 central time. And that's actually another thing about that Sunday, November 5th, is the time is going to change. So,
yeah. Oh, geez. Oh, God.
You get an extra hour. But so Aaron, that's 2:20 to 3:20 for you on Eastern time.
Okay. I think
that's Eastern Standard time.
My calendar app has it wrong, but I think that's because it knows the time is going to change on that day. So, I just need to write it down on a piece of paper. That'd be easiest.
Yeah, so that is.
I'm sure you guys will remind us.
Yeah. yes. Where are you?
Yeah, we'll remind you. But it's great that it's fall back instead of spring ahead, because I think
it's yes.
a total basket case then. So.
Does anyone want an extra hour? David?
Can I get two, three?
Yeah, I'm just not on there.
I'd listen to that.
6 hours, yeah.
I honestly thought we already switched the clock, so I'm glad you told me.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah. So they really should just do away with standard time altogether and just keep it on daylight time. I don't understand this, like, what is it, like, 8 months of... You get like 8 months of daylight time now, and like four of what's even the point? I don't even.
You gotta go out and work the fields, man.
I guess. So again, that's 1:20 to 2:20 central time on Sunday, November the 5th, which is also we're gonna have a big Guy Fawkes Day celebration that day. So.
Oh, nice!
Yeah. Make sure you wear your V for Vendetta masks.
Don't do that.
All right. David Metcalf, what are you going to be talking about?
I am going to be talking about something to dress the trash up. Something to dress the trash up at midnight, which is what Vampyra called horror hosts. And I'm going to be looking at the 20th century horror hosts as sort of an initiatory figure, and looking at how strange it is that in 1957, you know, Screen Gems releases a package of Universal, what they're called Vaulties. So movies that at that point weren't really getting shown in theaters, and Universal wanted to make money on them. So Screen Gems and television was taking away market share from theaters and studios. And so one way that they realized they could get around that was to take this old intellectual property, repackage it, give it to the television stations who needed content, right? Television was new still in the late 50s, and people didn't really have a concept for how to fill dead space and air. You don't want to hire people to create a new show. We've got these movies, right? And everybody needs to make money, so let's put these out to the airwaves. But what's interesting about horror is that, you know, Dracula and Frankenstein were the two ones that were the first ones to show on TV, but Dracula, when it was released, was hugely controversial, and it was considered deleterious to the society. There were all these amazing letters written into Universal about, you know, just how appalling it was that this was being shown, and this was, it was a big deal. And Frankenstein, the same thing. There's actually a the famous It's Alive statement. The actual statement is, "Oh my God, I now," or "Oh my God, I now know what it is to be a god. It's alive." And that got edited out because they were like, "No, you can't be showing that." And these are pre-code, right? Like, these are pre-code horror, yeah. But still, they were causing controversy. Then you had the, you know, the Motion Picture you know, Association come in and create what was a kind of a, the studios agreed, it wasn't necessarily that they were censored, but they agreed to self-censor so that they didn't get censored, which just meant that, you know, there was censorship. And that's why you have the switch from the original kind of run of Dracula, Frankenstein, and those, and the way that they were sort of framed. Then you have moving into stuff like Son of Frankenstein, you know, Son of Dracula and that, which are a little bit, you know, up to the Abbott and Costello movies, right? And then go into the 50s with the monster movies and all that. But point being, right in the mid-50s, horror comics get nixed by Congress, right? There's a huge congressional thing. They're like, you can't show this. There's rules, no zombies, no werewolves, no vampires, no anti-Christian statements, no occult, like all these different rules, which is, you know, now known as like the comic book authority, right?
No, so fun.
What's that?
I said, no fun.
No fun. Take it all out, right? When, I mean, there's hilarious things from that congressional hearing, though, where like they've got one of the covers that they showed. It's a woman's head cut off, and there's like an axe, you know, and there's blood coming out of it. And the publisher was asked, you know, like, is this what you're showing, you know? And he was, and they had said it in a very specific way, and he corrected them, right? And he was like, well, we don't actually show the blood, you know, like, it was like the way that he framed it was just like, well, we didn't quite get that graphic, you know. But so comics get censored. And then in 57, because of the Screen Gems package of Universal stuff, suddenly this stuff is on your television, right? And so one of the interesting things that comes out of that, though, in sort of the fact that this was a new venue. Vampire had come out in 52, and she'd done her thing, which had also been somewhat controversial, but was taken in good standing. The reason that she got taken off the air was that she wouldn't sell her intellectual property of Vampire. So she owned that, and she wasn't willing to give it to the station, and the station wanted it, and she was like, no, I'm not going to do that. So they took her off the air. And then 57 rolls around, and the television stations are given these press packages that tell them, you know, okay, so we've got, here's the licensed product, which is Dracula, Frankenstein, and the Universal horror movies. And here's how to sell it, right? And all the promos that they do are Vampire's promos. It's drive around town in a hearse, you know, all this different stuff. Bring the horror to your town, have different events, have kids come, and all this stuff. But what's amazing is this is a time of heavy censorship, right? And so these movies, like, they're not what the television station would ever show of their own volition, you know, but the people want to see them. And when Shock Theater came out, the public went nuts, and the money was insane. I mean, the ratings were crazy, the amount of money that they were making. I think the Shock Theater in LA when that premiered, and Shock Theater was the name that they put, because they didn't, I mean, it was Shock Theater across the country, but these were all different. This wasn't a syndicated show. It was just the Shock Theater package. So what do you call it? Oh, it's Shock Theater, right? Or Chiller Theater, because they were called Chillers or Thrillers, right? And so this stuff just pops up because of money, and it then explodes. And they have to figure out how to frame it. And so they have, you know, most like Zachary, John Zachary is a famous one. And he didn't even really watch horror. He was a character actor that somebody had seen play a pallbearer. And so they get him in there, you know, like a grave digger, and they get him in there to his bit. And it's just, it's this one-off stuff. It has nothing to do with the movies, really. You know, it's local theater being portrayed by, you know, random character actors that they could pull into the studio. Or sometimes it was the weatherman, you know, after hours and stuff. And so it creates this whole format. But what the format in doing that does is it creates what in Grand Guignol was called the hot and cold shower, where you would have something that was comedic and then you would have something that was really visceral and nightmarish and bloody. And so you have these comedic interludes in between these movies, which as time goes on into the 70s, like when the initial Universal thing came out, it made so much money that all the studios were like, well, crap, we need to package our stuff and hand it to television shows. When AIP wanted to fund the Roger Corman Poe movies, which was their entrance into the kind of the middle tier that wasn't the exploitation kind of B-movie stuff for drive-ins, the Poe movies were set to more of like a middle level of the market, and they wanted them to be in color and they wanted them to compete with the Hammer product, you know, Hammer, like the Dracula and Frankenstein with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. And so they funded that through selling off literally their entire back catalog up to the year that they sold it to television stations, right? So this wasn't, now we're used to streaming, a movie comes out and, hey, why can't I watch it? You know, it's in theaters, but I want it now. And then, you know, wait a month and it's there. Or sometimes they're simultaneously released. Back then, you know, you may never see a movie again. It may go to a theater and then it was gone, right? And this was really something different, where these movies would come out in the theaters, they would go in grindhouses, and they would go in the second run theaters, and they would go into drive-ins and that. But once the television kind of horror thing happened, suddenly they were on TV, right? And the AIP stuff is not the Universal stuff from the 30s and 40s. AIP is much more visceral, you know. And you also had the fact that there were copyright rules that they were trying to get around, because again, money. And you don't want to pay a lot. Well, it's much cheaper to get stuff from Italy or Japan, and that's where Godzilla comes onto TV, right? Or the Black Sabbath and some of the, you know, the Italian horror. And it's just amazing to look at the list of things that were shown on local television stations, you know, which even now would, you know, be considered to be rather, you know, spicy fare for people to be, you know, enjoying. And this whole, you know, the other thing that comes out of that too is the fact that the money that they were making on that made it much more interesting for those products to be bought in by larger kind of conglomerates. And so the intellectual property gets traded up, and that's where you get, in the early 60s, you get the product licensing for Universal, which leads to horror and that being associated with Halloween. And so, you know, this whole kind of horror culture that we have now, the development of it is so centrally tied to this really interesting period in the late 50s where these movies were licensed. We had horror hosts come out, show them, you know, and then that all kind of disappears by the 80s. And then by the 80s, you have Elvira come out, which was supposed to be a Vampyra relaunch, but Vampyra wanted more creative control than they wanted to give her. So they just changed the name a little bit, changed it up a little bit, and you have Elvira.
Yeah, Elvira stole her stick, stole her act, basically.
No, she didn't steal it. No, she was given it. Like they, you know, they wanted. I mean, that's kind of the sad thing is that, you know, it was an actress who needed a job, and so you know, she took the job and she took the character and she did it great. But you know, it was from the studio end of it, from the production end of it, it was stealing Vampire's intellectual property.
Well, I don't want to give too much away because I want people to come watch your presentation. But one point that I want to make about that I find interesting about the whole horror host phenomenon is the local nature of it.
Yeah.
And how like that is something that's like gone. And I kind of growing up in like the late 70s, early 80s kind of caught the tail end of it. Mm-hmm. But like my dad's generation, you know, he can remember there being there was a horror host in Chattanooga that he remembers. So like Dr. Future remembers somebody in Louisville. You know, he was old enough to remember that. And then like there was one here in Nashville, and like every like town or every market had their own horror host. And that's just something that's just like gone completely because everything now is syndicated. Everything now it's like it's the same TV shows on all the time. It's like that's an art form that there's a few people doing it like on the internet and such, but like you'll see it on late night, but it's not like something that, but even that's like nationally produced.
Yeah, and that's something I'll be or distributed, right? Like a lot of it is if it's on the internet, it's folks that are doing sort of a
collab. It sounds like that really creates the or shapes the taste of the next generation of horror filmmakers, that interplay with the...
It did. Yeah, it did at one time. And, that's some of the stuff that we'll be looking at is just what does it mean? And I'll be looking at that, too, like we're talking about, Adam, where what does it mean now, right? Because you've got Joe Bob Briggs. Yeah. He's got a show. Sven Gulli, who is local to Chicago.
Which I saw Sven Gulli's Rubber Chicken at the Rubber Chicken Museum here.
Yeah. You sent me a picture.
There's a guy here in Nashville, Dr. Gain Green.
Yeah, Dr. Gain Green. And what's interesting about Dr. Gain Green is that he's actually involved in kind of like archiving horror history.
Yeah,
he's really involved in sort of cultivating that. It's a fascinating thing that existed for a period of time for a very specific reason. And what we have now is kind of reflective of, you know, people reflecting on that and recreating it, which I think is similar in a lot of ways to a lot of the kind of media that we have today. Very reflective on the past and recreating it in sort of a pastiche or an homage, but not quite getting the core of why those things popped up in the first place.
Very interesting. Okay. It's great to have these kind of cultural stuff. It's always an element of strange realities. Mm-hmm.
It's a good reason for me to watch horror movies. I mean, that's absolutely really the crux of this was I was watching a lot of horror movies. So
and it's perfect for right after Halloween. So
yeah.
On Sunday, November 5th, 12:10 to 1:10, David Metcalf is presenting. That's Central Time. So David, 1:10 to 2:10 for you.
Since everyone
here is on, everyone that's speaking is on Eastern Time on Sundays.
If anyone knows any organizers of horror conventions, I really think David could hit that circuit.
For real.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big audience out there.
I did that thing I did for Miskatonic was fun.
Yeah.
The parapsychology, Cold War parapsychology and horror movies. That was fun.
Well, last but not least, Chris Ernst, who is starting us off on that day.
Absolutely. Well, funnily enough, I am going to talk a little bit about Dracula and Frankenstein and Mark of Zorro, because they were all written by this fellow Garrett Fort. And he's one of the people that I will be talking about who are, I'd say, pre-1960 individuals or movements that really influenced, I'd say, art, culture, and specifically media, but came from an esoteric space. And so it's in many ways an extension of some of the stuff that we were talking about when we did the show with AP on cinema and the occult, but it's getting a little bit more into some folks that people maybe haven't heard of and the work that they've done and how influential it's been to a lot of the the filmmakers that I think are kind of, and listen, I love David Lynch. You know I do, and everything proves that. But I think he's been talked about a little bit, you know, to death in terms of occultism and esotericism. And same, I'd say, for Kubrick, really. And I think there's some other folks like, and Kenneth Anger, for that matter, too, like Maya Deren, or some of the surrealists like Germain Duloc, Garrett Fort, and all of these people, and then some theorists that were involved with them, like Guy Debord and Siegfried Krakauer. A lot of these folks were coming from spaces, particularly spaces of esotericism that had to do with ideas of consciousness and accessing the mind through different types of media. And a lot of it was really probably best understood under the umbrella of like experimental art. And you also see at the same time, beyond sort of the influence to some of these famous filmmakers like Kubrick and Lynch Kenneth Anger that people talk about a lot, there's a heavy parallel track that's going on in the experimental art world, which very much intersects with experimental cinema, but then goes off on its own. And you've seen the sort of warped shape of that in terms of how Pizzagate interpreted Marina Abramovich and spirit cooking and things. But in general, I'm going to focus, even though I'll talk a little bit about how it seeps into what's happening now, I'm mainly going to focus on folks from prior to 1960 and sort of where their influences came from, the works that they did, and then how those sort of trickled into the zeitgeist that we see now. It's a very short explanation, but I can talk more about the details then. I feel like I don't want to give too much away, honestly.
Right. This is just a preview. Yeah. Just to get people interested. In,
but I'm happy to answer questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's quite the all this stuff together. I mean, just shows what Strange Realities is all about. It's kind of difficult to define. And we've probably had a little bit of struggle with our messaging just because it's really just all the disparate shit that we're interested in.
Well,
that sounds like a great lineup, everybody. I'm really looking forward to all this.
I'm looking forward to listen to these.
I'm glad that, kind of just really quickly, Chris, I'm glad that you're talking about that, because the horror host is the initiative, sort of an initiatory figure. To be able to follow up your discussion of,
absolutely. Right. Knowing that you're going to be talking about that, I'm gonna think about that and try to, set up some stuff.
Stuff like this usually happens. There's usually kind of coincidental trains of research between different speakers we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm really interested to hear.
And just to let everybody know, Chris Ernst speaks 11 to 12 o'clock. That's Central Time, so that's 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock for you, Chris.
Absolutely.
Okay. Just to a point to how to like to define or the difficulty of defining Strange Realities. I mean, I just think we have such a pool and a resource of talent and people that really think outside the box and really think, much further than just like, oh, there's Bigfoot. Oh, I like ghosts, or I like aliens. We've got people that really do research and people that really are concerned about, other issues and other things. And also just like dig deeper into so many subjects and are just like serious researchers.
Yeah. Versus maybe more entertainer personality driven.
Right. Right. Not that I don't think any of our stuff is entertaining, because I think it is.
Are you saying Tim Banal's not entertaining?
I know.
What were you saying, David?
I was saying, and we love ghosts and Bigfoot too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
What, Chris? Since
I had a flash in my head when Aaron mentioned Adamski's burger stand. Was that an influence on Hill in the Hole with
I mean, it was absolutely talked about. Yeah. It was more like we only have access to a fried dough truck, but we'll, you know, somebody will get the reference. It was originally talked about as a burger stand, if I remember correctly. Yeah, awesome. Bill, the guy who wrote the script, is like he knows everything. He just, you know, he's a crazy recluse. Not recluse. He's a different person. Sorry. Yeah. Gosh.
And we know who played the fry cook in
right. The fry cook was Tim Banal under the watchful eye of Adam Gorightly.
A nice thing that went on too.
The tutelage of Adam Gorightly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Zach, I know that you'll probably have to take off here about 10 minutes or so.
I got to get to bed.
I wanted to ask, you know, I really wanted to take this opportunity since I've got you as kind of like a really, you went to theology school. I mean, you're basically a trained theologian. And Aaron,
I fake it.
You fake it. Aaron is an historian. And guys, also, you know, feel free. I mean, you know, this has been a crazy week in the last week. So we touched on it a little bit when you were talking about what you were going to talk about for the conference, but I just kind of wanted to get you guys' thoughts on what's going on right now from those perspectives.
The views expressed on this podcast are internal. Not necessarily
all right.
Seriously. Go ahead, Zach, since you got
I was going to say, I appreciate you not, you know, choosing a controversial topic, you know.
Right.
I think the most honest answer is just there's not any easy answers, you know. Like, I think in moments like this, we want easy answers, you know. You want, like, clear divides, you know, and, you know, be able to clearly choose things. And sometimes, you know, it's just messy, you know. And sometimes it's like there's this very clear and obvious bad thing, and then there's this good thing, and then it goes back and forth. And you know, it's kind of a tale as old as time, you know, and just to use a theological term, it sucks, you know, like it just does. Like, you know, what Hamas did was awful. You know, what's happening in Gaza now is awful. You know, like there's just, it's all awful, you know, and I wish I knew, you know, how to solve it, or at least, you know, make the violence stop. But I mean, I think for me personally, you know, what I've tried to do in my work, you know, is not obviously, you know, directly tied to Middle East policy, but, you know, religion, you know, is clearly an underlying thing that's going on and has been going on there and in this thing. And for me, in my context, which is, you know, far less, you know, serious, you know, in day-to-day, you know, evangelical, fundamentalist, progressive Christian kind of circles, you know, is the importance of just being able to admit, you know, that you could be wrong about things, you know. And like, I mean, that's something that I personally, you know, I know growing up in fundamentalism, struggled with, you know, that there was a possibility that I could be wrong about anything, just never entered my mind. And I think when that happens, and we kind of have that dogmatic mindset, it makes it easier to draw, you know, lines in the sand and to demonize people and to make enemies, you know, out of strangers. And, you know, I don't know, you know, what the answer is, but I know on this side of the ocean, you know, far removed from all of the chaos and the violence, you know, a good dash of humility from, you know, folks on, you know, Twitter or Reddit or wherever who are now Middle Eastern policy experts, you know, could go a long way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Maybe disentangling it from the revelations as well.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Don't spoil my talk. Come on, man.
I think from a historical point of view, this is not new. It's not the same conflict it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. But the roots of it are there, and what I see are people using the deaths of innocent people in the region to indulge their own bigotry thousands of miles away. And that concerns me greatly. From a guy who reads foreign affairs point of view, I am very concerned about regional stability. I'm worried about Lebanon getting involved. I'm worried about this expanding throughout the region. I'm worried. I'm hoping Iran doesn't do anything stupid. I think there's a lot of things to be concerned about, including the consistent defaulting to a military solution to what is a diplomatic issue. And that's what terrifies me, is that there's got to be a way, and I don't see anybody in power in the region working towards building a framework for a lasting peace, which is something that when I was in college and high school, we just sort of back in the 90s, we just sort of assumed would happen at some point, right? Well, we had the Camp David Accords and, you know, they're talking and we've got this stuff, but I don't think there's any sort of, Levant located equivalent of the Good Friday Accords coming. And I don't see I don't know what the path forward is. I don't, but I am convinced that even in the face of horrific terrorism, that the military solution might be playing into the hands of those who want to stoke further hatred. And there's no good answer. This isn't me being like, well, both sides. It's difficult. This is complex. There's a reason nobody's come up with a solution, right? It's not like there's a solution that the Illuminati are keeping secret. This is tough. This is tough.
Yeah, I was, because of all this, I was looking back into it, just kind of refreshing myself on it and looking at something like the Oslo Accords, which seemed to have been a major step forward in the mid-90s. And it was just never really implemented for whatever reason. It just never really took place. There's certain parts of it that did. But what, has been interesting is that it seemed that this had kind of died down in a lot of ways. Like, you really weren't hearing about it very much in, like, our media over here.
That you weren't hearing about it in our media here.
Yeah. I think it was like a day-to-day thing there, and then all of a sudden this just happens. And it seems like there's been some speculation that Hamas did this just to completely derail any possibility of any kind, because they don't want any kind of negotiation with Israel. They want none. And remember that Hamas Palestine is basically split, really. Mm-hmm. Between two different factions. So,
I and this is not something that I necessarily would speak as truth, just because it was something that I was listening to recently, but I think it's worth noting. He's a professor at UPenn, Ian Lustig. Anyway, he's an expert in this area. And, I was listening to him, on a podcast, and he was talking essentially about how, in his opinion, based on much research that he has done, that Hamas is essentially Israel, the right-wing Israeli government wants Hamas because Hamas is a terrorist organization, which is something that is very bad, but it's something that is not it is not as legitimate as, say, what Arafat and PLO were doing, and that this is something that is there's far more nuance, like geopolitical nuance, as with everything. But, you know, he made a pretty convincing argument. And he also mentioned the other thing is that, you know, depending on where you start the story, it's a very different one. So if you start the story on October 7th with the brutal and horrific terrorist attacks by Hamas on Israel, it's a very cut and dried situation. But if you start the story in 1948, it's a very different story that you're telling. And so I think these are just all things we need to consider when we're thinking about it, us, you know, especially me and many of us not being experts on this and being far away. One of the most damaging things, I agree, is the amount of disinformation and essentially like sports, you know, sportsing of this, where you're taking on a side, like as if this was the Super Bowl or something, or the election, you know. It's
that's a really good point about the role Hamas plays as a foil to the Netanyahu government. I was reading, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was in Foreign Affairs, and basically the Netanyahu government has you know made a consistent case that with Hamas in its position, there's just nobody to negotiate with. We can't negotiate. You can't negotiate with these people. And the Palestinian Authority has been weakened and has little credibility among Palestinians. But yeah, you know, it's hard to think, like, man, remember for the stable days of Arafat and the PLO? Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, wishing for the Cold War back, right? The future is a terrifying place, and then reptilians show up. And,
don't worry, we've got it all under control.
You know, they're coming for our women, and you know it's a huge terrifying thing to
reference that CFR. Fact publication, Foreign Affairs. There,
you know, I was really hoping that by subscribing to Foreign Affairs, I would be considered a member of the CFR. But apparently, no, I am not. I'm not nearly that cool or rich. But I will say they've got their. When you subscribe to Foreign Affairs, you get access to every issue ever published, like back to the 20s, which. For somebody who teaches history, is a really good resource.
Oh man,
give students things to read. So,
well, I want to. I know Zach's got to get going, so I want to. Zach, thank you for being here with us tonight and doing this and being a part of the conference. Again, to let everyone know, you are speaking Friday evening at 7:30 to 8:30. That's Central Time. So, guys, you know, look at your clocks. So, Zach, I just want real quick, just please tell everyone where they can find you and about your books that you have available.
Yeah, find me on the internet. My handle on Twitter and Instagram and Threads and Facebook is at Zach Hunt, but with two A's because somebody stole my name and I tried to be clever and I'm not clever. But yeah, I wrote a couple of books, and there's my daughter, Unrapture, which is, you know, kind of what I'll be talking a lot about at the conference. I wrote a book more recently called God Breathe, which is, you know, debunking biblical inerrancy, but with Unrapture stuff, especially, you know, what we're talking about now, you know, the influence of end times theology on what's going on right now, is pretty, direct, and intense. So if you want to know the idea of the Antichrist and the dates for Jesus' return and all the, you know, answers about the future, I'll be giving them away at the Strange Reality Conference. So
excellent.
I'll find out all the secrets about the end times.
It's got something to do with the Council on Foreign Relations. I just know it.
That's what I was told at the meeting.
I'll get you.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil, no spoilers, but I will give all the secrets to the end times.
Oh, okay, cool.
Excellent. All right, Zach, thank you so much for joining us. And guys, strangerealitiesconference.com.
Thank you guys so much. I'll see you guys in a couple weeks.
See you. Thank you, absolutely. All right. Some squishmallows showed up.
That's right.
Yeah, I, you know, I, I decided I'd take the opportunity there to talk about that a little bit. David, I don't know any thoughts on it or.
I don't. It's nice. I think my thoughts are at some point. Yeah, I don't know. It makes me happy. I live in a rural area. I kind of share Adam's. It's a pretty big powder keg to be kicking right now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of destabilization all over the place, and having that kind of destabilization at a central sort of hub of trade and movement, especially with Netanyahu talking about making a connection line between Europe and Asia, and that, I mean, it's just, it's a lot.
Yeah.
It is a lot. So I've been watching horror movies and escaping like a small child into that kind of stuff.
I've been doing a lot of the same. Yeah. It's like, oh wow, I'm gonna, oh, my Blackadder DVDs. I'm just gonna watch these all day.
Yeah,
I should be doing that. Yeah.
I mean, it's a little too much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. It's also made me reflect. I mean, I guess I don't know. It makes me reflect personally more than anything else on just being a better person, and just trying to be more, more open, because we don't know. I mean, I just did that whole thing on the Cold War stuff with the parapsychology and that, and just it was just like just shoving my head into like nuclear fear. You know what I mean? Just like amped up, just consistently hitting that like nuclear button, and then I look out on this. And we don't even have kind of like the narrative controls that the Cold War had, you know, which maybe sort of speaking to that, like, oh, I wish we had the Cold War. There was a narrative there, right? Yeah. There was some kind of like good guys, bad guys, you know, and even if you were in Russia, right, there were good guys and bad guys, or the Soviet Union. So we don't have that. Everything's so decentralized now. And, it's not just nukes. Between the misinformation and disinformation, and I mean, there was up in Chicago that the Palestinian kid, he and his mom had come like a decade ago to get away from the violence in Gaza, and they went to Chicago, and the landlord had bought the kid toys, had actually had a friendship with this family, and then this happens, and he's freaking stabbing the kid and his mom and the kid's dad.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just, it's madness. And that's just sparked from this situation. But we also have every other horrible thing going on in the world, which is just dividing people and which is just causing, you know, this sort of just like horrible mind virus of violence that just, you know, just is expressing itself in random killings. And it's not good.
Yeah.
As someone who believes, though, very fundamentally, both at a spiritual and sort of a practical level, in the fact that cycles rule the world more than people think they do, or rule creation, I guess part of the introspection that this is, it's prompted in me, is to think about cycles in the world, and how one understands being a human amidst the cycles of time, which is a pretty big thing to think about. But that's my way of answering. How often do I think about the Roman Empire?
Yeah. That's
Thank you. Thank you. Well,
and to bring it back to the horror movies too, and the shock package, the Freevee and Amazon just made a deal with Universal, it's the shock package. It's the exact shock package. So you right now can go and relive that moment in 1957 when those things were released on Freevee. And Freevee actually has a channel too. They've got the Universal Monster Channel now. So I'm glad you said that about the cycles, because completely less important way, I was thinking about the cycles, where I was like, oh wow, it's all coming back.
We need the monsters to save us.
Yeah, or distract us. I mean, really, just to distract us. I make no contention that I'm any better off for just shoving my head in the sand with horror movies.
Well, I mean, something has to be said to just the media environment that we live in now. You know, no one used to constantly think about these things all day. So that's probably not healthy for any kind of discourse, period. So.
No, I'm trying to just sort of sit down and do whatever the digital equivalent is of
reading when paper.
Yeah, sit down once a day, read the news, put it down, go on with my life instead of just doom scrolling constantly. And it's not even just doom scrolling for news now. It's everybody's thoughts on the news. I mean, I can sort of handle oh wow, this is a lot of bad news coming through in these news stories. But hearing and having, you know, I don't follow these people, but they're shoved in my face anyway. Random opinions, well, not random so much anymore. It seems to be a whole lot more targeted nowadays. Opinions thrown at me, and it's like, look, nobody commenting on Twitter has any power to do anything. And I think that's frustrating because we get all this information and we have all these feelings and we have no power. I mean, which is good. Experts should be handling some of these things, right? Like foreign relations. But it's just, we get so much information, but we don't have any more authority or agency to do anything about these things on the other side of the world. It just riles us up and in some ways turns us against each other, and we get exposed to these horrible events without any context in a lot of cases, unless you've been studying events for the last 70 years or something. You're just seeing, oh my gosh, this is horrible. Well, somebody should do something about that. And it's like, well, let's go back 100 years. Let's go back to the dawn of Zionism and the Ottoman Empire and all of these things. And well, no, that's hard. Can't we just, I don't know, bomb somebody or something? And it's that's the thing. The more you learn, the more you realize you don't know much. And no matter how much you know, there's other people in charge who make the decisions. That's cheery, but
yeah, right.
Well, and that was something that I looked at for that Miskatonic thing was the, the internet. Diana Pasulka writes about this in American Cosmic, but the internet, before there was the internet, even before there was the ARPANET, there was a project that was called something like Augmenting the Human Intellect, and that was actually what led to the internet. So the internet that we have now is literally a military intelligence tool, which was set to augment the human intellect as kind of an extended mind. And that was the intention. And so you look at something like Jacques Vallée wrote a paper in 1975 called Computer Conferencing, an anomalous form of communication. It was the altered state of communication. So computer conferencing and altered state of communication. And then this paper in 75, he's writing about the early computer conferencing stuff, what we're doing here, and the atemporal qualities to it. And one of the things that he writes about, you know, a lot of positive things, people can connect from all over, right? We're all in different states and we can all talk and globally you can communicate and stuff. But what they found even back then when it was just scientists and engineers and researchers and government people communicating, military, whatever, academics and stuff communicating, violence, anger, misinterpretations, all the things that we see now on a mass scale were evident in these small groups of professionals who shouldn't have necessarily had those reactions to this. So in the very medium itself is baked in that sense of violence, helplessness, this weird atemporal distortion. And so then it gets rolled out commercially, right? And that's what we have now. And so, you know, all these things that you're describing, you know, and just people feeling like, oh, I need to have something to say and I need to do something. What do I do? And then other people being like, oh, I saw this and I can't, oh, I need to go stab somebody. Those things were inherent in this very medium. You know, and it's really interesting that this technology was supposed to be an extension of the global human mind, right? And it very obviously has, the global human mind has some pretty glaring behavioral issues, you know.
Deep
emotional trauma and problems, you know, which are now all just being accelerated by this thing. And the internet too, the other interesting thing is that it was a reaction to the nuclear bomb. In the sense that it was literally made to decentralize command and control structures, now rolled out commercially, you know, and it's just these kind of the implications of what we have in front of us and what has just spread globally has never been addressed, because it's a conversation now where the global human mind is on and we're all connected, and we never had a conversation about doing that. Somebody who, again, back to the horror movie and money, you know, like they didn't think about like, oh, hey, we just censored this, you know, because it wasn't a we censored it. It was some guys in Congress censored it, and we're going to make some money because people want to see this stuff. And whatever they say, we'll skirt around that, you know. And that's the same thing that happened with the internet. Like, oh, we've got all this evidence that shows that people go crazy when they use this thing. Well, we're going to roll it out and make money because it also can, you know, it makes it easier to control things. And then you get Omni Magazine and all these utopian visions, you know. And it's just, it's moving, rolling forward. And then we get, you know, into these situations where these, like you're talking about, age-old, millennia-old conflicts are now exacerbated by this hyper-connected state that we're in.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about the Reformation lately, and just that kind of what the printing press did and all the consequences from that world shattering. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, we don't even understand what print is. I was thinking about that. I'm doing a talk tomorrow on public writing. You know, it's for college students in like a cognitive philosophy class, but we don't even know what text is. You know, I mean, we don't really know what it is. We don't understand what it is. We don't
like most of the public doesn't know all the media theory of like television to
games,
but now we
You know, and now we have this stuff. We're just all sort of blindly moving forward as the technology develops and our communication and that, without ever really reflecting on what it is that's happening.
Well, nobody's read McLuhan. Well, some of us have, but the general world has.
Everyone here probably has.
The question about how often do you think about the Roman Empire? I think the real question is, how often do you think about the Holy Roman Empire?
A lot, actually.
Yeah.
Me too.
Am I teaching it the next day? If so, then yes, I will think about it.
Well, Sir Fiel, if you're reading about the Reformation, you're thinking a lot about the Holy Empire right now.
Yeah. Yep.
Just saying.
I was just trying to refamiliarize myself with the period between Constantine and the first caliph, which I felt like I didn't have enough. I wanted to refamiliarize myself with what happened in between then. Granted, I didn't get far, but there's more.
Sounds like a hell of a good time.
I mean, if you really want to, if you get asked that question by your significant other, just be like, well, which one do you mean? Roman Empire proper, the Eastern Roman Empire, so 1453, or the Holy Roman Empire? Which one? Or the Ottoman Empire? You can even include that in there if you really want. I mean, just hit them back with that.
Yeah,
that's the best way to do it. All right, guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Always a good time.
Yeah, I want to remind everybody, about Strange Realities Conference, as we do. You guys are going to be so sick of hearing about it by the end of this, but we're just gonna nail it into your head to get your tickets. And guys, please tell everybody where they can find you. Chris Ernst, we'll start with you.
Brightrectangle.com.
All right, and sometimes Where Did the Road Go? You're on there.
Oh, well, yes, and sometimes Where Did the Road Go? But I never want to take that's Soraya. But you'll find me there because, you know, he's a buddy of mine and he likes to have me on sometimes. So, yes, you can find me. But go there anyway.
Soraya will be joining us next week.
Yeah, and, awesome.
Aaron?
Saucerlife.com or wherever you find your podcasts.
All right. David?
DavidMetcalf.wordpress.com, although I haven't really published much. Been doing more just kind of offhand talks, so check there. I usually post it there, or David B. Metcalf on Twitter.
Okay. And I'm really excited to see you guys' presentations. I think this is going to be this is going to be really awesome, guys. You don't want to miss the third day, the online day, because there's going to be still a lot of great information.
It's going to be hot.
Yep.
Trying to organize maybe some like watch parties too for the Nashville folks.
Yeah, it's going to come in hot on Guy Fawkes Day. So. Please,
good one.
Remember, there you go. We're going underground. We're gonna set up an infernal machine. And
you're gonna burn the 3rd through 5th of November. It's strange.
All right, so guys, strangerealitiesconference.com coming up November 3rd through 5th. November 3rd to 4th are at SIR Nashville, and November 5th is online. However, the entire conference is online, so do not forget that. And tickets are still available online. Access for all 3 days is $30. For the 2 days at SAR, that is $70. And that also gets you the online access if you're coming to the conference. Please just get into the Facebook group. Well, I will ask you to get into the Facebook group if I see you there. Please get into the Facebook group. That is attached probably to your ticket. If not, I will send it to you. And you guys can get in there and you can watch the entire conference if you miss anything. So you're not going to miss anything.
The sooner everyone does all of that, the better, too. So
the better, yes.
In there ready to begin.
All right, Sir Phil, anything that you want to add?
StrangeRealitiesConference.com. Please get your tickets as soon as possible.
All right, guys, we will be back next week with another set from the online only day. We will have Michael Hughes, Timothy Renner, and Sarai Askath. And I want to thank Christopher Ernst, Aaron Gullius, Zach Hunt, and David Metcalf for being with us tonight. And remember, StrangeRealitiesConference.com. Get your tickets as soon as you can.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.